ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the fourth session of a series of five panel discussions under the auspices of the Art Dealers Association of America on the general subject of behind the scenes with the New York art world. This fourth evening will be devoted to a discussion under the title of What's It Worth? Problems in Valuation and Appraisal. Our moderator this evening will be Tony Randall, who needs no introduction to you as a distinguished actor, but who appears with us tonight in his role as an art enthusiast. I am sure that he will perform that role as successfully as others in which you have seen and heard him. The members of the panel are Robert C. Graham, Jr. and Klaus Perls, each of whom heads his own gallery, member of this association. Gerald G. Stiebel, who with his father, Eric Stiebel, heads the firm of Rosenberg and Stiebel, also a member of the association. And finally, I, administrative vice president of the association, who this evening will, in addition to this introduction, also serve as a member of the panel. I turn you over to Tony Randall and the panel for the evening's discussion.
Thank you. Now, I'll have very, very little to say this evening. The panel will do the talking. I've never permitted even total ignorance of the subject to inhibit my expertise. But these men really know their stuff, and I have a job to do. My job is outlined in Xerox, and it's worth reading to you. Moderator should allow 5 to 7 minutes maximum for each speaker. This was the first subject brought up. Are you going to take pictures all the time we're here? What is your name? Make fun of it, of course. Yes. There are annoying people like that sent by God. The first subject brought up was, shall we limit it to 5 to 7 minutes? And it was agreed that I will let people speak for 10 minutes. At 8 minutes, I will whistle, and at 10 minutes, no mercy. Finished. Okay, next. If moderator wishes, he may have the same 5 to 7 minutes before fielding questions. I don't want it. It is the moderator's responsibility to field and target questions appropriately and to end each discussion. We will have questions. I will repeat your questions because we are wired not merely so that you can hear us, but that this is being taped, and we want the questions to be on tape. The questions should have some reasonable relevance to what was being discussed tonight. Moderator must end panel at 9 p.m. sharp. This is the only important point. Because I haven't had my dinner yet. All right, now we'll begin. I will reintroduce to you Mr. Colin, and I should tell you that he is not a dealer nor an artist. He is a collector, and he is a lawyer and one of the founders of the ADA. You're on.
Thank you. I think the first thing we ought to say tonight is to be certain that we know what we're talking about. When we say, what is it worth? We're talking about dollars. We're talking about what something is worth in the marketplace. Not its aesthetic worth, although the aesthetic judgment sometimes plays a part in determining what the dollar value of a work of art is. Unfortunately, there's nothing like a stock exchange in the art market. There's no place where you can get a quotation on your work of art. And even if you could, it would be useless, because there are no two works of art that are exactly alike, unlike two shares of U.S. Steel. So what do we fall back on? We fall back on that inexact thing called expertise. Inexact, but very definite, always there, and very definitely provable. Who is an expert? What is an expert? There are members of associations of appraisers who will undertake to appraise anything from a Cycladic figure or a Turkish rug to the latest work by Andy Warhol. We at the Art Dealers Association think that ain't not possible. We don't believe that an expert can cover that much ground. We believe in the old definition of an expert as a man who knows more and more about less and less. And we think that members of the association and other dealers who are not members are the real experts in the field of what is it worth, because they are the ones who are dealing always in the marketplace and, in the last analysis, have to put up their own money in buying things so that they'd better know what things are worth or they'll be out of business in a very short time. Before the Art Dealers Association was organized in 1962, the common practice for donors to nonprofit institutions was to get an appraisal of a work of art at as high a price as they could get, being prepared when the IRS man came in to audit their return to compromise at something lower. This presented a tremendous problem to the Internal Revenue Service. They didn't have the expertise to check on art. They had experts who could appraise real estate and who could appraise factories, but they didn't have experts who could appraise art. And for a long time, there were rumors in Washington that Congress was going to abolish the deductibility of gifts of works of art for income tax purposes, simply because they couldn't handle the problem. One of the most important elements in the formation of the Art Dealers Association was to create a competent and honest system of appraisal. And the first thing that happened in the spring of 1962, after the organization was formed, was for Alexander Rosenberg, our first president, and myself, to go to Washington and meet with 8 members of the appraisal staff of the Internal Revenue Service and tell them how we intended to proceed to appraise works of art. As a result of our system, we have developed in our office what I think is the largest card index in the world as to who knows what about what. And the refinements are such, for instance, that there are dealers who will undertake to appraise a late Max Ernst, but not an early Max Ernst, for the very simple reason that they know the market in one and don't know the market in another. They don't purport to know everything about everything. How do we proceed? When an application comes in for an appraisal, we select a panel of 3 experts with respect to that particular work of art, that particular artist, that particular school, and we send the appraisal out for 3 independent appraisals. The appraisers don't know who was making the gift and who owned the work of art, with one exception I'll come back to in a moment. And they don't know each other, again with one exception. In other words, each one appointed to the panel knows that he's got the job, but doesn't know who the other 2 members of the panel are. The exceptions. These being real experts, without knowing who the donor is, in many cases they suspect the donor because they are so familiar with the particular work of art and the field in which they're working that they probably know who owned that picture. That we can't help. Similarly, knowing the expertise of the various members of the association, they might guess who the other members of the panel are, but they don't know. Now, what is the result? In the early days, 20 years ago, I was staggered as the results came in, because in about 95% of the cases, the appraisals from the 3 independent people were so close that I shuddered. What happens when they're not close? Well, if we get 3 appraisals of 95,000, 100, and 105, we average at 100, and we think that that's meaningful. If we get 3 appraisals of 50, 100, and 150, we don't average at 100 because we don't think that is meaningful. Where there's a spread from $50,000 to $150,000, taking an average doesn't mean any sense. When that happens, it's perfectly evident that some members of the panel aren't up to date. And for the first time, the three members of the panel are informed of each other's existence and are asked to get together and straighten things out. In the overwhelming number of cases when that happens, they do straighten things out. What happens is that one didn't know of a recent sale or wasn't aware of some development which influenced the market. If after getting together, the three experts still can't agree, the matter is referred to the entire board of directors of the Art Dealers Association, which meets once a month. And the board, while not perhaps as expert with respect to the specific work as the three members of the panel, has a general knowledge of the market and, I suppose, from time to time makes its own decision as to which one of its own members knows what he's talking about most. In any event, a decision is reached. There's one other case in which the matter has to go to the board. From time to time, particularly with new and young artists, we can't find three experts, three people who know the market. In such a case, where there's a young artist who's being promoted by one gallery, it's usually that single gallery that really knows what the market is, and it's that single gallery which gives us the appraisal. In that instance, before the appraisal goes out, it has to be reviewed by the board. Now, what's the result of all this? We've been in existence for just over 20 years. We've appraised over $500 million of works of art. In a contested case with the IRS, we have lost one case, a reduction of the value of a Gauguin from $450,000 to $425,000. And the reason is quite, I think the reasons are many, but there are two important ones. The first is that the IRS, without any commitment that we are official, has learned that the association is both competent and honest, and in most cases is prepared to accept its appraisals. The second reason is that if and when, and they do from time to time, contest our appraisal, we then point out to them, we then for the first time give to them the list of people who acted as experts in making that appraisal. And we say to them, in a word, whom have you got? Can you top this list? They know what they're talking about. Have you got anyone as good? And in most cases, they haven't. Now, of course, there are cases where a client, without our consent, wants to dispose of a year of his income tax audit and settles the case without our approval. Wrong word, approval, without our knowledge. We, the IRS knows, will not compromise $1. If we appraise something at $100,000, we're prepared to defend the $100 and won't settle for $99. Our service of appraisal includes going to tax conferences with the client and, if necessary, testifying in court in support of the appraisal. As I said, the client, however, may elect in a given instance to dispose of a year of his audit by compromising, and of course he may always do that.
You want to quit now? You got 15 seconds.
I'll quit now.
But what you were talking about principally, or only as far as I could figure, was appraisals for the purposes of leaving or giving something to a nonprofit institution. Is that correct?
That is the only time in which the art dealers will appraise. We do not appraise for insurance purposes or for the general knowledge of the owner. We leave that to other people, usually individual dealers.
And did you say if you charge for this?
We do charge. Oh, I should have mentioned this. The dealers who make the appraisal get no fee. A fee is charged by the Art Dealers Association, the money being used to administer the association. But the dealers get no fee for their services. It's entirely pro bono publico.
Thank you. If you have questions, save them, and we'll get back to this, because our next speaker is Robin Graham.
Thank you, Tony. What is it worth? Let me give you some examples of problems I've confronted over the past few years. I'll change some of the names and numbers, but not the substance of the examples I'll give you. My hope is that I'll answer some questions, but I'll raise even more, which perhaps you can pose and we'll answer as we go along. Recently, a collector of American paintings was offered $800,000 for an important American genre painting. was perhaps the most famous and important known example of this artist's work. He had bought the painting for approximately $400 in the 1940s and had no intention of selling it. However, he was carrying on his insurance policy at only $125,000 and felt he had to do something. His first thought was to give it away. An $800,000 gift could do a lot for his tax situation. But then he found it would be difficult, if not impossible, to obtain an appraisal on the painting for more than $250,000 to $300,000. Other major works by the artist had been sold, but none for more than $200,000. There were no prior sales records to support a value of $800,000. So what's it worth? The $250,000 that might have been acceptable to the IRS for gift purposes, or the $800,000 he was offered? I'll tell you what he did. He took the $800,000. But as far as I'm concerned, the picture's worth at least $1 million. It's a great painting, and another one doesn't exist. I bought a pair of Ralph Blakelock paintings from my own collection several years ago at a price that I felt was less than half their true value. I submitted the auction house bill to my insurance company and asked that the painting be insured for the amount I paid, which was $9,500. The insurance company responded that the bill would not do. I must have an independent appraisal. The appraisal by an independent appraiser was the amount of $22,000. Now, I would mention this is only weeks after it was purchased at public auction for $9,500. That $22,000 is what they were insured for. What are they worth? This was several years ago. As an aside, today they're probably worth closer to $30,000. Last season, a collector of Western art asked me to buy a Western bronze form at auction. I examined it carefully and advised him that it was a fine example and the slightly more desirable of two versions of this subject that had been made by the artist. We bid slightly over $21,000 for the piece, and we failed to buy it. Several weeks ago, I located a superb cast of the other version, and in consideration of its being the slightly less desirable variant of the two, I sold it to him for $18,000. Meanwhile, the one that we didn't buy at auction is currently on the market for over $40,000. So what's it worth, and who's right? A friend of mine bought a painting a few years ago at a contemporary gallery which specialized in the work of young, relatively unknown artists. He paid approximately $3,500. No one else represents the artist or handles his work. His work has never been sold at auction. My friend asked me what it was really worth, and that answer depends. If he wants to sell it, it is worth only what he can get for it, which, unless the gallery has a buyback policy, in the case of a young and unknown artist like this, is not likely to be much. On the other hand, if he wants to insure it at a replacement value, it is worth what he paid for it, or the current price that that artist commands today through his gallery. But I would say in that case, what it is really worth is the value of the pleasure he derives from it. While I'm on contemporary art, perhaps I should say something about this special field. Our gallery deals in paintings and sculpture by 19th and early 20th century American artists, as well as contemporary art. Because no one else on the panel deals extensively with younger and somewhat lesser known contemporary artists, I would like to discuss briefly, and I emphasize briefly, because I think the question and answer segment of our evening should prove the most interesting and informative, the specialized problems in dealing with appraisal and valuation of work by an artist as his career evolves from obscurity to prominence. Initially, the only marketplace for an artist's work is that of his own gallery, in most cases at least. The artist and dealer will normally set the prices, and if the work sells, then that is the value. Generally, there is no secondary market through other dealers or through the public marketplace of the auction. When such work, when appraised, can generally only be valued at the price which is paid for it, or replacement value, it will probably have little or no resale value in the public market at that time. However, as an artist's career evolves, assuming he's successful and has built an ever larger record of exhibitions in galleries and in museums, and at some point, a secondary market will begin to develop. This is normally a painstaking and evolutionary process. Once a secondary market develops for an artist's work, then problems of valuation and appraisal become more conventional. But you should be aware that when there is no secondary market, you're dealing with a different bird. I do hope I've provided you with more questions than answers. Thank you.
That's it? You only went
That's
six
it.
Minutes.
Yeah.
Well, I have one. I'll have a question right now. You raised the question of if the price established at an auction for a work, is that its real price? Is that its true price? Is the last price the real price?
Well, that's one of the, I think, one of the open questions that I tried to raise, which is not that easy to answer, because when you do have work which can be sold sometimes at auction appreciably higher than what one would consider its normal retail value, or appreciably lower, it raises questions which are very difficult to answer, and that's why I tried to use a couple of examples here. And I'm not certain how that question should be answered, and that's something I think it's worth discussing.
May I save an answer for the question and answer period on that one?
On auctions,
yeah.
Right. Klaus?
Well, I can start out by addressing the question that you just raised. As far as I'm concerned, question of worth. There are two things. If you buy something for resale as a dealer, you have to consider what you're going to resell it for, and therefore you arrive at a bid that you can make which will allow you a profit. On the other hand, if you buy as a collector, not for resale, then a work of art is worth what you can afford to pay for it. To illustrate that, I want to mention a Picasso self-portrait of the early period that was sold at public auction to a Mr. Cherry for about $7 million. And it had been sold not too long ago at another public auction for less than one-tenth of that amount. And if it were to be offered again now at public auction, it may very well not bring more than, say, $2 million, which was the price at which it was appraised at the time when it was sold for seven. The fact is, Mr. Cherry wanted the picture, and someone else also wanted the picture, and Mr. Cherry could afford to buy it for $7 million. Therefore, to him, it was worth the $7 million. But that's an emotional approach to buying and to valuation, which we as dealers must try and avoid, although it is sometimes difficult to do that when you are offered something which you like very much. If you personally like it very much, then the dealer very often becomes a collector, and he says to himself, well, this is so beautiful, this is so special, that I will buy it at the price that I have to pay, even if I have no chance of reselling it at a profit. It'll be nice to live with until I die. And that's the answer to that. Now, there are other things that I want to go into about what it's worth. In the art market, there are a lot of things which influence the value of works of art, which have absolutely nothing to do with art itself. There are political situations where, for instance, in the early 50s, Senator Joe McCarthy decided that one shouldn't be a communist, and Picasso was an openly avowed communist. Therefore, people in this country were reluctant to buy Picassos. Picasso prices went way down, and it had nothing to do with the art value of Picasso. There are entire countries sometimes that are involved in this, when, for instance, a country makes difficulties in export of its art treasures, say Mexico will not export pre-Columbian art, or India will not export Indian art, all of a sudden, these things become very rare on the market, and as a result of that, they may go up in price. On the other hand, they may also go down in price, because people who buy certain things, say, of Indian origin, are not at all certain that someday they aren't going to be told that these were, in effect, stolen things which belong to the state of India and must be repatriated, as, for instance, it happened to Norton Simon. There are still other possibilities. Now, the first one, of course, you know, is supply and demand, and that is very clear. Another one is nationalism. The incredible increase in the value of American art is due to the new American chauvinism when it comes to art. And there's a little sideline to this which is interesting, and that is that if you look back through history, you will find that when a country achieved great military, economic, and political power, its art became very popular throughout the world that had to do with that country. As a result of that, I did not find it at all surprising that the paintings made in the School of New York after the Second World War, the abstract expressionists, became immensely valuable. It may have had nothing to do with the art value. It may have had to do primarily with the fact that for 30 years, the United States was the most powerful country in the world. So these are the various possibilities for influencing art prices. In addition to that, you have the phenomenon of the generation gap. When a generation, say, likes very much to buy Corot paintings, to such an extent that even numberless forgeries of Corot paintings were sold at high prices, the generation following is likely not to like that kind of painting so much. And as a result of that, a lot of the paintings bought at high prices by one generation, in the next generation, land in the attic. But in the third generation, these paintings may then come down from the attic, and as in the case of a lot of the American paintings now selling at hundreds of thousands of dollars a piece, achieve an entirely new status with an entirely new public. And finally, there is the possibility of a special dividend for art when a country all of a sudden becomes rich enough to buy art and likes certain things which in the country of origin are not particularly savored. The example for that is the Japanese. When the Japanese balance of payment went up and up and up, and the Japanese had lots and lots of dollars with which to buy things abroad, they started to buy art, and they bought it in quantities, and they bought the kind of art they wanted. They wanted, for instance, especially things like late period Utrillos and very charming Marie Laurencins and, of course, Fujitas. These paintings in France and in the United States were in those days relatively inexpensive. And the late Utrillos were selling at a fraction of the price of the earlier white period Utrillos. But that all changed because the Japanese had dollars to throw away. And so now, at this point, we find that some of the finest, from my point of view, paintings by Utrillo can be bought for less than the routine paintings of his last years. So what we're coming to is that what it's worth has so many different aspects and is influenced by so many disparate situations that arise not only in the place where a thing is offered for sale, but also whether it is sold for resale, whether it is sold to a collector who is not going to resell it, whether it happens to be in fashion for one reason or another, or as we go on and on and on, more problems. I don't know how much more time I have.
You've got 40 seconds.
I have 40 seconds?
Yes.
Well, in that case, I want to also say that we dealers don't always put our own money into things. Quite often, especially in these days, things are so expensive that we use outside money, people who trust us and will let us play with their money. It is part of the general casino atmosphere of New York City.
Very good. Good. You have 10 seconds left, so I'll ask you. You mean people just invest in you as they invest in a Broadway show?
With about the same chance of result.
One out of 10. Yeah. And the way to do that is to invest in 10 art dealers at the same time. And that's the way the smart Broadway investors do, or used to anyway. The next is Gerald Stiebel.
Thank you. I am the representative of Old Master Paintings on this panel this evening. And in my field, there's an added problem, the problem of attribution. Because attribution makes all the difference. A best example is David Carrot's discovery of a Fragonard in the Lord Rosebery sale, which Sotheby had cataloged as Van Loo being a very good French 18th century master, but not nearly as important, as popular, or as valuable as Fragonard, and he was able to buy it in the auction at a very reasonable price and sell it to the National Gallery in London. If one could find a painting today by Leonardo da Vinci, you could be sure that it would be worth millions if it was recognized by everyone, if it was a nice subject, if it was in good state of preservation. But should the painting only be attributed to Leonardo with many dissenting opinions, it might only be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, or maybe much less. These are all problems of connoisseurship, which, as you've heard earlier, are all important factors in making an appraisal. In order to make any appraisal, one has to make comparisons. If you've only seen one Rembrandt in your life, it is both the best one you've ever seen and the worst one you've ever seen. You have to start somewhere. If you know that an early Rembrandt, a good early Rembrandt, is worth $2 million, you can go from there to say an ugly early Rembrandt is worth less, or a late and much desired Rembrandt would be worth far more. And then you have the problem of how do you value the very best. I know about 10 years ago, the Art Dealers Association was asked to make an appraisal at the Frick Collection here in New York. And my father was on the panel at that time, and they were confronted with the problem of the St. Francis by Giovanni Bellini. How many millions do you value that painting at? 25, 50, 75 million? If it's an aesthetic judgment, there is no possible figure you could put on it. But the IRS talks in their appraisal manuals about a willing buyer and a willing seller. And they decided to take the position of what they could conceive the most affluent, most willing private or institutional buyer would spend on such a painting. And I believe at that time, about 10 years ago, they came to the conclusion that it would be worth $10 million. I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about one of the more formal aspects of appraisal, which is widely publicized and not very well understood, and that's the Art Advisory Panel of the IRS. Now, I'm not a lawyer or an accountant, and I'm only going to speak to you as a member of that panel at the present time. The Art Advisory Panel of the IRS was started through the cooperation of the Art Dealers Association of America and the American Association of Museum Directors when Sherman Lee, director of the Cleveland Museum and president of the Directors Association at the time, went to Mr. Colon and asked for his cooperation and his association's cooperation in setting up the panel concept. Every work of art, be it a painting, sculpture, or furniture, valued for tax purposes at over $20,000, must be sent to Washington. Anything of a lower value may be sent to Washington by a local agent if he feels he cannot handle it at his level. There's a small team of IRS agents, about five, who are quite knowledgeable in the art field. In fact, some of them are pursuing advanced degrees in art history. They research each and every work that comes to them through auction catalogs, catalog resume, and they also inquire of specialists in the field. And a selection of what they have been given is presented to the panel of experts, the art advisory panel, including museum people, scholars who serve for 3 years each, and dealers who serve for 2 years each on the panel. We review the material which is sent to us in advance of our meeting, and we can consult with experts around the world. We are not given the name of the taxpayer, nor whether the work of art is given for gift purposes or estate purposes, even though, as was mentioned earlier, we know our field quite well, and we may recognize some of the works of art. Problems are sent back for development, asking for more information, such as a bad photograph. We may ask for a better photograph. We may ask research to be done in certain books, or we may ask certain individuals who we feel are greater specialists to comment on a work of art. And you might be surprised to know that many works of art are appraised in the taxpayer's favor. I've seen gifts raised and estate values lowered. Appraisal is not an exact science, as you've heard so much tonight. The more information available, the better the appraisal. Therefore, the panel situation allows a great deal of expertise to go into every decision. The IRS is looking for what they call a quality appraisal. It's amazingly easy when confronted with the photographs and the appraisal to see which have been done conscientiously and which have not. And the best example is if we have a beautiful color photograph, we know it's probably a gift. And if it's a blurred black and white, it's probably an estate. I wanted to end on the note that Ralph Cullum began with, that no one can possibly be an expert in appraising all fields of art, much less be an expert when they appraise linens, real estate, and art as well. The individual who has the most experience buying, selling, and dealing in whatever field it might be will make the best quality appraisal. Thank you.
Well, you didn't use up your time. Now we have questions. Yes, right here. How do I put that on the tape? What does museum showing do to art values, and how do values differ in one country and another? Fair enough? Okay. Gerald?
If I can take just the first part of that. In Old Master Field, I personally do not believe that a museum show has ever increased the value of any work of art. It does create more interest in a field, in artists, and it may help from the dealer's point of view to present his works of art and to make them more easily saleable. But I don't believe it changes the value of the works of art.
What about contemporary?
I'll rephrase that. I remember not so many years ago, the Modern Museum had an enormous Bonnard show. Seemed like hundreds of Bonnards. Did that affect the Bonnard market? Klaus?
No, not to my knowledge. I do believe, however, that for instance, the Museum of Modern Art had a big exhibition of the abstract expressionists, which put them on the map. It gave them the kind of stamp of approval that made it possible for some people to buy them and display them and pay money for them. I do believe that when there is a very successful museum show of an artist, say, for instance, the recent El Greco shows, that the demand for such artists may slightly increase, and because the number of paintings on the market is the same, the price might indeed go up somewhat.
But quite often, the museum shows come about because of the popularity of the artist, more than the other way around, in the old master field.
You have something to say?
Yes. There's a pattern that occurs, I think, both with exhibitions and also very often at the time of an artist's death, a prominent artist, and that is the publicity surrounding an exhibition or the passing of an artist ending his active career creates, no question, very often a greater demand, but also the notoriety sometimes creates a greater supply because people who own those paintings think this is a wonderful opportunity to sell them. Depending on how that balance works, prices may go up or even decline at that time. Very often after that period, you'll find the prices will rise because that hidden supply has been absorbed and there is less supply and there may be a continuing demand if this is a prominent figure.
It used to be a rule of thumb that when an artist was selling at under $10,000 a piece, then there was a certain clientele for that artist at that price range, and when the artist's pictures got to sell for more than $10,000, a new group of people came into the market and started buying them. And also, conversely, when pictures were selling for little money, people bought them and hung them on the wall because they liked them, but then if they got to be worth $10,000, they felt that they couldn't really afford to have something worth $10,000 hang on their walls, and they would turn around and sell it. So you have a certain balance created with the up and downs of the market.
That raises a question that maybe I'll ask before someone else does. When something goes up in value, then you finally have to insure it. And fine art insurance can be prohibitive. Have I answered the question that I asked?
Well, this is a very tough question because in certain countries, like say France, people will not insure their art for the very simple reason that they don't want it on record, that they own things worth that much money. In this country, the thing is that is not a point, and people will insure their art, but very often not for the actual current value, unless they want to every 2 or 3 years review their insurance policies and bring them up to date.
Will an insurance company appraise?
The insurance company will ask the owners to supply appraisals.
Mr. Cole.
One of the dangers that collectors see in insuring for the full value is that if they die, there's then a record for estate tax purposes, and they don't like the full value to appear as a matter of record for estate tax purposes. That plus the, as Mr. Randall's pointed out, the high cost of insuring art tends to make collectors underinsure rather than fully insure.
The example I used earlier was typical of the type of situation you allude to, where a collector had a painting valued by himself at that time and insured for in the neighborhood of $100,000 and suddenly becomes aware that this picture really has a value in excess of $750,000. That not only increases his insurance or increases his liability for not insuring it, but it creates a sense of responsibility, which is all of a sudden vastly greater than it was before. And this, no question, has an effect. People have to make a decision at that point whether they intend to continue both the financial burden of insuring and the responsibility of owning a work that's that important.
Man has to judge his own capacity for anxiety then when he buys art.
Absolutely.
Here's a question, right? Second row.
Does the Art Dealers Association recognize the expertise of the American Appraisers Association?
Does the Art Dealers Association appreciate the expertise of the what?
American Appraisers Association.
American Appraisers Association.
We don't recognize or not recognize any other associations. We simply feel that our system is better than any we know of. But there's no question of recognizing or not recognizing them. They don't need recognition. They've been in existence and they operate. They don't need our stamp of approval.
Right back there.
What are some of the pitfalls that the novice should know about in dealing with, you said before, like the buyback policy of a deal?
What are some of the pitfalls that a novice should be warned about or should know about before he buys art?
Oh, I guess I raised the question, so I'll start to answer it, which is you ought to find out very clearly what policy, if any, there is, and whether, if there is a buyback, that there are some that are promoted as guaranteed buybacks, some with a profit, some with a sliding scale as the prices of that artist's work go up. You would receive that in credit in exchange for another painting. I don't believe in them. I think if you buy a painting, you should buy it because you want it and you're willing to pay that price. If you're interested in such a program, I would investigate it very carefully. I think sometimes people can go back to exercise their rights under that and find that it isn't exactly what they thought it was. You should make sure they put it in writing.
Second row.
Although the art advisory panel is not told the purpose of an appraisal, whether it's for an estate or a donation, appraisers usually are told the purpose and usually find sales data to give a high or low valuation depending on the purpose. How do the members of this panel feel about that, and how does the IRS feel about that?
I have to rephrase that for the tape. How could I put that briefly? How does the panel feel about appraisers knowing? Appraisers giving high or low values because they know what's expected of them.
I can only answer from the point of view of the Art Dealers Association. We give one value. Our best judgment as to what the real market value of the work is. There is no change in approach or attitude, whether it's a gift tax case or an inheritance case. And we think that that is the only honest way to appraise. The work has a value, at least our best opinion as to its value, and we give the same value in both cases.
Let me try to talk again about the IRS panel. If each of you can imagine in